They're insects.
Yes, as far as the North Koreans are concerned, we were quite beyond the pale. We were puppets of the, or we were lackeys of the, how do you call it, there were the Americans, and then below them there was Syngman Rhee, of course, whom they hated. So I don't think we had much time for Syngman Rhee either, but still, that's beside the point. We were quite beyond the pale as far as Kim Il-sung and his General Nam Il and co. were concerned. And I think they were probably, in those circumstances, have just simply dispatched us out of hand. In fact, this did happen. There were very, very few in the early days of Task Force Smith, which was when the Americans first came over here, first committed ground troops piecemeal from Japan, under Colonel Smith. There were very few who survived, who were taken prisoner and survived that initial incarceration by the North Koreans. One, of course, notably, was General Dean, the original commander, who was captured. And obviously they felt it was worth keeping him alive. But there were a number of instances where ground was recovered and Americans were found, American corpses were found with the hands tied behind the back, and, where they'd literally been executed. So, as I say, thank goodness in a sense, where the Chinese were no angels, thank goodness it was the Chinese.
So all this came up with you saying that you had been separated into these groups and about your poisoned finger.
Yeah, that's right. And so shortly after that, those of us who were left were moved across the road to another village, which was a much larger village. I don't know the name of it. I must find that out one day, because I'm sure I can find it out. But we moved across to this larger village where we met Sergeant Gordon H. Woods and PFC Robert Eugene White. Now, why should I remember those names? I think probably because we spent some time with them in that area.
Were these Americans?
These Americans had both been wounded. In fact, Bob White had the misfortune to be sitting on one of his own tanks, I think, when it was hit by an enemy bazooka. And he lost one foot. And the other one had been broken. The ankle had been broken. And it had set at about a 30-degree angle. His foot had set at a 30-degree angle to his leg. In other words, sticking outwards. And he obviously couldn't walk. And he used to shunt himself around on his bottom. And he really chuckled as hell, you know. He couldn't walk, but what the hell, he could get around on his bottom, he could take part in discussions, he could see, he could talk and everything. And so he was really, really cheerful. There were these two Americans there. And then, after a while, various other people were brought in, and then they were shipped out to various other, I won't go into all the details, not how well I think. But basically, eventually it settled down to there were four of us. There was Graham Bailey, who now lives down in Bristol. There was Bill Street, or Pop Street as we used to call him, because he was a reservist. Although he was only perhaps early 30s, he was obviously, to us youngsters, he was very much older, and we sort of almost revered him. Pop Street, Bill Street. I think he lives up in North London now, but I don't know where. I can't track him down. Myself, and Corporal Rodney I. Baker of the American Army, 3rd Division, I think. He was taken during that summer. He was taken after we were. But anyway, there were the four of us there. Now, there's been a lot of talk recently about being under friendly fire. A lot of talk. And it has saddened me very much that these people will not just let it die down and accept that things end. Wars are full of tragedies. War itself is a tragedy. And this sort of thing has happened in all wars that have ever been, and sadly it will happen again in the future. Now, we were in a situation in that village, the four of us, we were being looked after by the Chinese and living in this Korean house. Looking at a map of our situation, of our village, to the right of our village there was a road, to the left of our village there was another road, and beyond that road there was a railway. In our village, along the ridge line which went along behind our village, a north-south ridge, a low ridge line, there was dug in a North Korean-operated anti-aircraft battery, four guns. Now you can imagine that a situation like that called for a lot of attention by the American Air Force. Now we were under friendly fire nearly every day, weather permitting. The only times we were not under friendly fire at some time during a day was when the clouds had closed in and flying was not possible. So we were under friendly fire most days, and often at night as well, for 5 months. Not just for a couple of hours, 5 months, and we had 25% casualties. Now, all right, 25% casualties, in other words, of the four of us, one night, an American plane came over and dropped a bomb on the corner of our building, and it shattered. Well, it did quite a lot of damage. And ironically enough, the only one of the four of us who was wounded was the American. He was wounded by his own aircraft, in a sense. But, you know, we were under friendly fire. They didn't know we were there. At least we assumed they didn't know we were there. Because we were just, at that stage, the four of us, certainly the three of us British, we were just simply listed as missing in action. Our status as prisoners of war had not then been confirmed. It was not confirmed for the three of us, I think, until 1952. So we were simply just missing in action. So the UN command didn't know we were there. I suspect the Chinese high command probably didn't know we were there. The only people who knew we were there, besides ourselves and the local Koreans, were the Chinese authorities controlling that village. And as I say, we were under friendly fire. Most days and often at night as well, for 5 months. We were damned lucky, I suppose, that we were not, that we survived. During that time, we were being fed by the Chinese. We still, obviously, all of us by then had dysentery. And lice, body lice. We all had body lice. I know exactly where we got those body lice. I won't go into description, but I know exactly which. Much earlier on, about a week or 10 days after we were taken prisoner, we stopped. We were pushed one night. We were taken along the road in a truck, and we were pushed into a Korean house. And the old mama son was brought out, topless, as it were, stripped of the waist, because she obviously. Because they probably sleep in their clothing, their peasants' clothing. And we were pushed in there, and of course, following a couple of days later, we had body lice. Simple as that. So, we were managing to survive. And we were managing to survive against all the odds. Not only against disease, but against, I have to say, friendly fire. Against our own people. We were just as likely, in fact, one night shortly after that bomb, Bedcheck Charlie, as we used to call him, you know, twin-engine medium bomber, came over and obviously saw lights. He obviously saw something flicker or something down below and laced our village with 50 caliber bullets. And one of them came literally, and this is as good as mine, I know, but it was it was quite tasty when you thought about it. It came in, it hit me, because they're getting thatch roof and wooden timber construction. Hit the roof, hit one of the roof timbers, ricocheted off, and came between our heads, the two of us. Our heads were about sort of 2'6" apart, and it just simply came and went straight down. We dug it out of the courtyard, the earth, the next morning, and showed it to the Chinese, and as good as said to them, look, we're fed up with this. We want into a bunker. And they started to, they let us begin to dig our own bunker. And then, of course, and that bunker, if it had ever been completed, we got on very well with it, but if it had ever been completed, I can assure you that would have been, practically atom bomb proof. I mean, because we knew how to construct it. When we got well on with it, they decided that that wasn't any good, and they moved us into one that had already been dug in the side of a hill, underneath the anti-aircraft guns, of course. So there you are, as I say, that's, we were still under friendly fire. And were that way until we were moved out of that village just before Christmas 51. And up till that time, because I think probably your question now, listening to this, would probably be, well, what about prisoner of war camps? You've been a prisoner of war now how long? April, May, June, July, or September? Over 8 months you've been a prisoner of war. Why aren't you in a prisoner of war camp? Well, at that stage, when we left that village, we had no idea that prisoner of war camps existed. We didn't know. I mean, nobody had said, oh, well, you're going to a prisoner of war camp or anything like that. Anyway, we eventually arrived at the prison war camp just after Christmas, 1951. We had 8 months in that camp and 8 months in another camp.
What were they called?
The first camp was called Pyoktong, which is up near the Yellow River, which is Camp 5. And the close to the Yellow River, I've got a map
of it. I think we know where it is anyway. It's a familiar place.
Yes. And the... Cogden would have told you that, didn't he? And the other one, where I was from August 52 to April 53, when I was repatriated, was Camp 3, Branch 2, at a place called Songsadong. Songsa-Dong.
Branch 2.
Camp 3, Branch 2, yes. It was just a sort of a numbering system that they had.
Now, obviously, we're running out of time, and we can't really go into the POW life, but what I think perhaps you could explain in detail would be how you came to be repatriated, which was a bit special.
Yes. Well, of course, very briefly in the matter of the prisoner of war camps, of course, they certainly in the beginning, in the early stages, there was a lot of political indoctrination. This eventually tailed off. I think the Chinese realized that they weren't getting anywhere particularly. I think the Chinese never really understood, certainly, the British sense of humor. And we certainly never cracked the Oriental one. That's for sure. Completely, the two things were completely different. And I think they were as bad to get rid of us as we were to get rid of them. Then in April 1953, I have to say that July 1951, the armistice negotiations and peace talks, they were called, loosely called, started at Panmunjom. And then they continued fitfully, and one side or other breaking them off, and then reconvening and all the rest of it. And eventually they decided that they would have an exchange of sick and wounded in April 1953. And that is when I was in fact repatriated. And we were brought south in very, very smart Chinese operated Russian lorries, of course, a lot of their equipment was Russian. they were very friendly then. That was before they fell out over there with the northern Chinese northern borders. And a very, very smart convoy of these Russian trucks, all with aircraft recognition panels, which the Americans provided, obviously, neatly tied onto the bonnets and so forth. And we made our way south in daylight. I must admit, that was perhaps more hair-raising than you might think, because the Americans were monitoring our progress, and this was all arranged, you know, so they weren't fired at. And their aircraft would fly, you'd see a couple of these American aircraft sort of flying over and circling around. And at one stage, we came past what was obviously a Chinese or North Korean anti-aircraft battery, and the anti-aircraft guns were following them around like that. I thought, please, don't shoot at them, you know. Because if you shoot at them, they will shoot at you, and they will probably shoot at us. You know, because a thing like that, I mean, you can't, there's no time for the niceties. If you're under fire, you're fighting for your life, and you're going to retaliate, and if your retaliation happens to go clean through a load of your own people, tough. So be it. Anyway, eventually we got down to near the repatriation point, and we were taken into this like a sort of temple type building up on a low hill. Taken in there. And the Chinese, if nothing else, they're past masters at psychology. Absolute past masters at it. They're putting you, literally bringing you to the edge of the precipice and then pulling you back again. And they would come in, you'd be all sitting around on these sort of bed things. And Chinaman would come in, get out a piece of paper in his pocket, he'd open it out, he'd look at it, look all around the room like that. Fold the piece of paper up, put it in his pocket, walk out. Just like that. In other words, having brought your one of my names on this. You all chat amongst yourselves, and then, you know, he brings you to almost a fever pitch.
Sounds like playing with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely playing. Rather like the Russian roulette type of thing, except that instead of bullets in the magazine, he had a piece of paper in his pocket. And then perhaps he'd come in again half an hour later, same sort of thing. And then perhaps he'd come back in again later on, and perhaps he'd then read, in rather sort of pidgin English, perhaps half a dozen names. So those half dozen people sort of pick up the kit and off they go for repatriation. But they were playing cat and mouse with you right up to the last moment, it seemed. Well, they were capable of doing this right up to the last moment. And then, of course, as I say, eventually we were taken for repatriation. And we were greeted by Brigadier Kendrew. He sadly died a few years ago. He commanded the 29th Brigade. He was a quadruple DSO. DSO and three bars. You know, he was a rubber blue and all sorts of other things. He was a very wonderful, wonderful chap. But he greeted us because he was commanding the brigade at the time and shook hands with us. And then we were taken just down the road in our own ambulances. And we were sort of deloused and given, given a change of clothing, in other words, and a mug of tea and Red Cross and so forth. And that was fine. And then we went out and got into a helicopter. And I looked at this flight in the middle of my life. I know I couldn't have come to any harm, but I found myself sort of, in case the blades of the helicopter should sort of chop my head off. But I know it wouldn't happen, because, you know, you can walk under them quite happily. But anyway, then they took us down to an American hospital in the outskirts of Seoul. you know what they gave us to eat? Bearing in mind we had just been repatriated from 2 years of living on rice, sorghum, millet, and other cereals, turnip soup, and in other words, a very, very basic diet. And most of us still had the after effects of dysentery and so forth. And now we all have malnutrition. And they gave us steak, mashed potato and gravy, and they followed it up with ice cream. They hadn't got a clue.
What effect did it have on you?
Well, we just couldn't. We said, sorry, you know, we just sort of picked at it a little bit and said, I'm sorry, but, you know, not interested. We weren't interested. I mean, it didn't, you know, I can't describe it really, but, you know, I mean, we wanted time to adjust. We needed time for our system to adjust. Although, having said that, once you've had malnutrition, it never leaves you. It never leaves you again. You always got those symptoms inside you. Once you've had malnutrition, you're never completely cured. But I think all in all, I would say of that 2.5 years in Korea, 2 years in the West Indies was peacetime soldier. 2.5 years in Korea, including 2 years of POW, and that was definitely the dirty end of the stick. But it was all part of life's rich pattern. It was interesting. It was informative, and I think it was educational in a sense. And it was something which you could not, it was experience in life, in many of its aspects, that you could not get by reading 1,000 books or attending a university.